evening, everyone. This is Luke Beverly. You're listening to the Divided Kingdom radio show. You can hear us Thursday evenings at WWCR.com or on their shortwave, which is 4.840 megahertz on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also hear us a repeat broadcast Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. Also on WWCR.com. And on Saturday mornings, the frequency is shortwave 7490 megahertz. And you can hear us at various other venues as well. Global Star Radio Network and a number of others that are listed on our website, DividedKingdomRadio.com. Well, I thought I'd begin tonight with something that's happening on the very day I'm recording this. I'm recording it on Tuesday. Oh, let's see now, September 23rd. So autumn is now here. And this has been stated in a number of websites. I think NBC News has talked about it. Fox News has talked about it. The particular article I happen to have here is from Zero Hedge. And it says, Secret Service dismantles weaponized SIM farms, like SIM cards on a cell phone. So Secret Service dismantles weaponized SIM cards or SIM farms designed to shut down NYC cell networks. This is by Tyler Durden, Tuesday, September 23rd, 2025. And it was written at 8:45 a.m., just to kind of fit it into the schedule. Hours before President Donald Trump's address to the United Nations General Assembly, the U.S. Secret Service announced that it had dismantled a massive, decentralized SIM farm network just 35 miles from New York City, hidden inside five abandoned apartment buildings. The telecommunications stealth weapon was capable of paralyzing regional cell networks through denial-of-service attacks. Here are some key details from the Secret Service report. Investigators seized 300 SIM servers and 100,000 SIM cards across multiple sites. The devices enabled anonymous threats, encrypted communications, and could launch telecom attacks such as disabling cell towers, denial-of-service attacks, secure communication for criminal enterprises. Early analysis shows links between nation-state actors and known criminals. CBS News described the seizure as the largest of its kind, noting the network was scattered across abandoned apartment buildings at more than five sites, roughly 35 miles from New York City. And here we have a quote. This network had the potential to disable cell phone towers and essentially shut down the cellular network in New York City. Those are the words of Secret Service Special Agent in Charge, Matt McCool. And he stated that in a video released in the report by the agency. Beyond DDoS attacks, the SIM farms could also support psychological warfare operations, such as mass disinformation campaigns, emergency false alerts, for example, fake evacuation tests. CBS, citing multiple officials briefed in the probe, reported that early findings suggest the network was used for communications between foreign governments and individuals already known to U.S. law enforcement. In our view, the likelihood of this being part of a larger threat vector for potential physical terrorism appears elevated. Consider this. Disrupting communications in tandem with a physical attack would be the playbook for foreign adversaries, or perhaps even the globalists. That appeared at Zero Hedge by Tyler Durden, Tuesday, September 23rd. Well, now this is myself, Lou speaking. There was a time when I thought, no, I don't want to get a cell phone or a smartphone. But then one day I got caught in the Chesapeake Bay Bridge going from the western side of Maryland over to the eastern side. Couldn't call my wife, Elizabeth. This was perhaps 10 years ago now. And it was a bad accident. And I was stuck in the bridge, actually, the highways leading up to the bridge. And at one point, I was at the very top of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. And I thought to myself, what a magnificent view this would have. However, I knew if I got out of the car, I would probably be subject to arrest. And at the very least, a heavy fine. So I stayed where I was and just inched along. Meantime, Elizabeth had no idea where I was. So after that, we decided, well, it would be a good idea to have a means to communicate, especially as we saw that more and more phone booths were disappearing because everybody had cell phones. So I got a flip phone, used that for many years. Then finally, when COVID came along and I was still teaching, for the last part of the last year I taught, we had to have a means to communicate with parents. And finally, I broke down and got an inexpensive cell phone. A smartphone, you might say. And I can realize now what a massive amount of confusion it would cause. If anybody gained control of this, they could do all kinds of mischief. They could put out false alarms about all kinds of dangers, from foreign attacks. Can you imagine what would happen if they somehow broadcast nationwide a false report about a 9/11 style terrorist attack? It could cause panic. Think back to the days, well, it's before my time, of course, and your time, no doubt. But think back to 1938 when Orson Welles broadcast that very famous War of the Worlds radio depiction based upon the H.G. Wells novel or novella of the same name. It created panic everywhere, even though Orson Welles announced at the beginning and midway through, it was just a radio play. It wasn't real. And that was in the days when things were pretty low-tech, and only radio was involved. TV hadn't come in yet. But it's incalculable if the entire cell phone broadcasting capability fell into the wrong hands. It's just impossible to imagine the mischief it could cause, the deviltry. Well, now, let's move on. Today, Tuesday, September 23rd, is the day that Kamala Harris's book is due to go on sale. I can't say I'm going to buy it, but I've heard a lot about it. And first of all, here's something from Fox News. Now, this article, I should preface, is not by someone who is just speculating. This is by Michael LaRosa, writing for Fox News. And before I read the article, I should tell you who he is. It says, Michael LaRosa is a former special assistant to President Joe Biden. He was chief spokesperson to the First Lady Jill Biden and House Democratic Leadership and U.S. Senate Communications Director. So he was in the know. He was in a position of knowing exactly what was going on. And he says, well, first of all, the headline reads, Harris is speaking. This time, she isn't bending to Biden's bullies. Again, Fox News, September 22nd, 2025. Quote, she has to run because, he has to run because she can't, unquote. She was Vice President Kamala Harris. He was President Joe Biden. The message was clear. Biden had to run because his team didn't believe she could. Quote, then why did you pick her in the first place? I asked as I sank back into my seat on Bright Star, the First Lady's airplane. Silence. Deflection. Business as usual. We were instructed to parrot one line. No one runs for president for 4 years. In other words, I'm interjecting now, anyone that runs for president wants to be there for 8 years if he possibly can be, or she. And it goes on to say that was the strategy. Harris's forthcoming book, according to recently released excerpts, says what insiders whispered for years. The Biden bubble was full of bullies. The former vice president is finally saying the quiet part out loud. Biden won the most votes of anyone for president in our country's history, but he never won the hearts and minds of the American people, and especially not of his own party. That fragile foundation collapsed fast. The Biden White House was filled with its share of cartoonist characters out of a badly cast high school version of West Side Story. They thought they were a BFD, a big effing deal, because they had worked in a previous administration, or because our campaign defied the odds and beat expectations. But they had no instincts for the shifting media and political landscape, and no instinct for politics, as it is now lived and practiced in the age of Donald J. Trump. There was no pragmatic truth-teller, because no one admitted that we weren't a movement. We swaggered like we won President Barack Obama's mandate or his congressional majorities. We hadn't. We lost 13 Democratic House seats on our way in. From the moment Biden won the nomination, no one ever wanted to admit the obvious. Democrats felt stuck with us, not inspired by us. Let me interrupt again and just say the us here is those who are in the Biden administration. And the speaker is Michael LaRosa, former special assistant to the president, Joe Biden, and chief spokesperson to First Lady Jill Biden. So that's who's speaking whenever he uses we or us. Going on, inside the White House, the Regina Georges of Biden's circle ruled like mean girls and policed loyalty. Staff were serving a president and first lady, weren't. I can stand corrected there. Staff weren't serving a president and first lady. They were serving a cult. You never knew when Regina was in charge or when the Bidens were. It was all blurred. Joe and Jill Biden were warm, decent, empathetic, but they enabled some of the nastiest and most mean-spirited people I've ever encountered in politics. That contradiction defines the Biden era. I believed in Joe Biden once. After hearing him and Jill deliver barn burner speeches at the 2018 Human Rights Campaign Gala, I was convinced he was the champion to take on Trump. As someone who endured relentless bullying growing up, Biden's words about standing up for LGBT youth resonated. I left determined to join his effort. A year later, Biden was in the race, and I was chief spokesperson to his very influential and active spouse. In the summer of 2020, Jill reintroduced herself to the country while launching Joey, her children's book about young Joe Biden, a national leader who stood up to bullies. And this is a quote, school was where the bullies were, unquote. He stood up for himself and, quote, also defended others from bullies, Jill wrote. Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi was more direct. She said, quote, I've never been that impressed with his political operation, referring to Biden's team. Valerie Biden Owens wrote in her memoir, we were expected to stand up to bullies, growing up Biden. Biden's final mission, he said, was to save the country from Trump, who Democrats consider to be the ultimate bully. But bullies are everywhere, even among Democrats, and despite his brand, even around Biden. When I entered the fraught world of part-time punditry, there were times I questioned the strategy direction of the Biden re-election effort. When the economic message was Bidenomics is working, I explained why it was an error and pushed alternatives. When the polls were bad, I said so. How could I say the sky is red when we all know it's blue? Quote, we will always feel like friendly fire to them, MSNBC television host Nicole Wallace Wannabe. But all you have is your credibility, she emphasized. I wanted to be taken seriously, not just another robot regurgitating thoughtless talking points. I balanced my love for and personal loyalty to the Biden family with candid and thoughtful analysis. But the president's bullies didn't see it that way. To them, I had taken off the team jersey by pointing out missed opportunities and mistakes. So they came for me. The example they tried to make of me was meant to serve as a warning to any Democrat who raised concerns ahead of 2024. The same bullies who claimed to serve a president who despised bullies were sending me a message. Shut up, or we'll humiliate you. In time, however, the roots of their insecurity would be revealed to the entire world on a debate stage, one tragic June night in Atlanta. Biden's bullies and their intimidation tactics would crumble over the course of four long, hot summer weeks, along with their credibility. Bullies don't win. They implode. Biden's bullies dragged him down and tried to drag Harris with him. Now they're out for her again. Recently, we saw a glimpse of that vindictiveness when a few of my former teammates reacted with ugly and, of course, blind quotes to the release of Harris's book excerpts. Inside the White House, the Regina Georges of Biden's circle ruled like mean girls and policed loyalty. But so far, Harris isn't bending. Not this time. She sees what I saw, what we all eventually saw, and she is standing up to them. As she launches her book tour on MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, I hope she continues to speak with unfiltered candor about her experience. Take it from a Democrat, she'll sleep better at night. Again, that was from Michael LaRosa, former special assistant to President Joe Biden and chief spokesperson to First Lady Jill Biden. And that appeared in FoxNews.com September 22nd, 2025. We have one more item on Kamala Harris. This one from the Gateway Pundit. The title reads, Kamala Harris admits she snubbed Pete Buttigieg as vice presidential pick because he's gay. Quote, too big of a risk, unquote. This is by Jim Hoft, came out today, September 23rd, 2025. The mask slipped again. Failed presidential hopeful Kamala Harris confessed in her upcoming memoir, 107 Days, that Pete Buttigieg was her first choice for running mate during last year's election, but she chickened out because he's gay. In excerpts published by the far-left rag The Atlantic, Harrison whines about how Buttigieg, quote, would have been an ideal partner if I were a straight white man, unquote. She went on to say, but we were already asking a lot of America to accept a woman, a black woman married to a Jewish man. Part of me wanted to say, screw it, let's just do it. But knowing what was at stake, it was too big a risk, unquote. So those were the words of Kamala Harris. And getting back to the article by Jim Hoft, so much for Democrats being the party of inclusion. Behind closed doors, Harris admits what conservatives have been saying for years, identity politics is nothing more than a tool to manipulate voters. And even Democrats don't trust the country to accept their own rhetoric. Responding to Harris's remarks, Buttigieg told Politico on September 18th that he was, quote, surprised, unquote, by this passage, and argued that Americans deserve, quote, more credit, unquote, than assuming they would reject such a ticket. He also said, you just have to go to voters with what you think you can do for them. Politics is about the results we can get for people, and not about these other things, unquote. It can be recalled that Harris had not won a nationwide primary vote before becoming the nominee. Kamala Harris was chosen only when Joe Biden dropped out. When pressed by MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, Harris delivered her trademark word salad and denied discriminating against Buttigieg, while in the very same breath, admitting his sexuality was a, quote, real risk. Rachel Maddow said, I guess I'd ask you just to elaborate on that a little bit. it's hard to hear that you, running as, you know, the first woman elected vice president, a black woman, and a South Asian woman elected to that high office, very nearly elected president, to say that he couldn't be on the ticket effectively because he was gay. That's hard to hear. Kamala Harris replied, no, that's not what I said, that he couldn't be on the ticket because he is gay. My point, as I write in the book, is that I was clear that in 107 days, in one of the most hotly contested elections for president of the United States, against someone like Donald Trump, who, there was no floor to be a black woman running for president of the U.S., and as a vice presidential running mate, a gay man, with the stakes being so high, it made me very sad, but I also realized it would be a real risk. No matter how, I've been an advocate and an ally of the LGBT community my entire life. It wasn't about any prejudice on my part, but we had such a short period of time, and the stakes were so high. Well, that was a little hard to understand in places. I guess that's why they call it a word salad. And again, that was from the Gateway Pundit. Kamala Harris admits she snubbed Pete Buttigieg as VP pick because he's gay. Too Big of a Risk by Jim Hoft, and it appears September 23rd. Okay, what else do we have in the news? Well, there's a great deal about Charlie Kirk, of course. Over the weekend, we had a very moving memorial service for Charlie, and I think everyone is pretty well filled in on that, so I won't go into that in detail. It would probably just be repeating what everybody has already heard. But I did have a couple of things here. This one from Fox News by Andrew Mark Miller, September 22nd. Conservative PAC, or PAC, turns tables on a left-wing narrative defending teachers who smear Charlie Kirk. And I'll just interject before I get to the article. We've seen all kinds of things where college professors, teachers, ordinary citizens, put out the most hateful kind of smear campaign with a bunch of lies. We'll talk about another one in an article from the New York Post in just a minute. This one says, from Fox News contributor Joe Concha, weighs in on the future of Turning Point USA, the organization Charlie Kirk founded at age 18, on Fox Report. Well, that's just a little preview. I think that's probably a video that you can see if you go to their website, foxnews.com. The main article begins with this. A conservative political action committee launched an effort to expose teachers across the country justifying Charlie Kirk's assassination online, and that PAC is pushing back on claims from the left that conservatives are being hypocritical about free speech. Stefano Forte, I guess that's how it's pronounced, F-O-R-T-E, executive director of 1776 Project PAC, spoke to Fox News Digital about the new form live on the organization's website where users can flag teachers and administrators who have justified Kirk's killing online, a form he says has already yielded an, quote, endless stream of tips, unquote. He went on to say many people are essentially happy that Charlie Kirk has been killed, and these people are in charge of the next generation. Unquote. As conservatives online have launched a variety of efforts to expose online hate directed at Kirk, numerous elected officials and pundits on the left have accused the political right of cracking down on free speech, which Ford called ridiculous. He said, that is, Mr. Ford said, when they had social power, they didn't care about our free speech at all. They didn't care who was canceled for having basic Republican opinions, or who was fired for supporting Trump, or even for retweeting Charlie Kirk. The only speech they wanted to protect is their own. No one is saying they can't talk. They can post whatever they want. But there are consequences. If you're openly celebrating the murder of Charlie Kirk, you shouldn't be teaching children. That's not about free speech. It's about judgment and character. These are cruel people, and it's dangerous to have them in classrooms. I'll just interject. This is Luke speaking. I was a teacher for over 40 years. And one of the things you signed when you signed your contract to become a teacher, and I think this is probably true in any part of the country, was that you would adhere to certain basic principles of good behavior, good appearance, and not subjecting the students to views that would be destructive. And, of course, many other things as well. But these people can't say, oh, we didn't know. I would challenge any of them to get out their contracts that they signed to become teachers and look at them, read the words. Like so many jobs, you don't have freedom to just say anything you please if you want that job. Now, if you're willing to give up the job, that's different. You can say basically what you want as long as nobody's being harmed in the sense of yelling fire in a crowded theater. But going on now, social media posts celebrating, justifying, or downplaying Kirk's assassination have been prevalent in the academic community, with many of the individuals losing their jobs as a result. In one case, Fox News Digital first reported that an administrator at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., posted on social media his thoughts about why it was, quote-unquote, fair that Kirk was killed, and then he felt, quote, no thoughts and no prayers, unquote, over the killing. It also points to something bigger. Now, these, I believe, are the words of Mr. Fort, or Forte. It also points to something bigger. If you're okay with Charlie Kirk being killed, then you're likely okay with people who agree with him, or people further right than him being killed too, Ford told Fox News Digital. He went on, that's a serious problem. So yes, you're amplifying their speech. They chose to make it public. We're just making sure people know what they said. And he goes on, or the article, I should say, goes on, the George Washington University administrator's Facebook post was liked and loved by at least 37 people, some of whom were employed at universities across the country. Mr. Fort told Fox News Digital, the rot is incredibly deep. Some far-left organizations like DSA even put out PSAs telling their members what to post. It shows how many of these people are out there self-reporting. They've gotten so comfortable in the cancel culture, they build that they assumed only right-wingers could ever get in trouble for speaking their mind. They thought nothing would happen to them. And again, that appeared in Fox News by Andrew Mark Miller, dated September 22nd, 2025. And on a similar note, we have this from the New York Post. AOC's lies about Charlie Kirk reveal the truth behind left-wing bile. Published September 21st, 2025. Again, in the New York Post. 58 Democrats opposed a resolution to honor the life and condemn the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk on Friday. The resolution is composed of a straightforward description of Kirk's accomplishments and beliefs as he himself understood them, as well as an articulation of the seemingly uncontroversial principle that, quote, leaders at every level, government, education, media, and beyond, must stand united in unequivocal condemnation of political violence, regardless of their ideology, unquote. It also read, the tragic loss of Charlie Kirk must not be allowed to deepen the divides in our nation, but instead serve as a turning point to recommit ourselves to better angels and to the timeless American principles of liberty governed by truth and the virtues of peaceful dialogue. That's what the resolution read. Now, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, nicknamed AOC, Democrat of New York, was among the dissenters to these sentiments. She said, "The majority proceeded with a resolution that brings great pain to the millions of Americans who endured segregation, Jim Crow, and the legacy of bigotry." She wailed that on the House floor. And Ocasio-Cortez went on, "We should be clear about who Charlie Kirk was, a man who believed that the Civil Rights Act that granted black Americans the right to vote was a mistake," she declared. She went on, "His rhetoric and beliefs were ignorant, uneducated, and sought to disenfranchise millions of Americans," unquote. And the author of the article says, "Ignorant? We know you are, but what was Charlie Kirk?" Ocasio-Cortez not only reminded the country of her deficit of character by smearing Kirk, but of her deficit of knowledge by flubbing the most basic facts. Newsflash, African-American men were granted the right to vote by the 15th Amendment. They were subsequently denied that right in many jurisdictions by discriminatory Jim Crow laws. But it was the Voting Rights Act of 1965, not the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that remedied this great wrong. Perhaps Ocasio-Cortez ought to spend less time on TikTok and more time hitting the books. The least the Congresswoman's constituents ought to expect of her is a remedial understanding of America's civic history. If only that was where the lazy, dishonorable lies ended. It is true that Kirk called the Civil Rights Act a mistake, and that it was among his most inflammatory opinions, one worthy of interrogation and arguably harsh critiques. Yet Ocasio-Cortez and the Legion of Leftists echoing her online are destroying their own reputations rather than Kirk's by taking his words out of context. Kirk explained, quote, "Parts of the Civil Rights Act were great," explained Kirk after being confronted on his stance by a student. He went on, "The intent was noble, which was to say that no American can be not allowed into a place of business based on the color of their skin or their ethnic heritage." Charlie Kirk continues, stressing his agreement with that objective. The problem, as Kirk saw it, is that these days it's used to, quote, "force men in female bathrooms and push forward the trans agenda," unquote. It also, quote, "created a massive anti-racist DEI army that then gave us affirmative action," he lamented. Now, the author of the article says there's nothing wrong with rejecting Kirk's argument as it was actually made, but twisting it beyond recognition to paint him as a bigot days after one of your ideological bedfellows robbed a wife of her husband and their children of a father is unbecoming of any adult, much less the leader of America's progressive political movement. Ocasio-Cortez and her miserable band of self-righteous know-nothings see Kirk's death as, above all else, an opportunity to virtue signal about their opposition to his life's work. By acting on this ignoble impulse, they've only advertised their own surplus of contemptible vices, ignorance and spite chief among them. All right, that hits back pretty hard at the opinionated Miss AOC. Now, let's talk about crime for a few minutes. And again, I'll interrupt to say a few people have asked for our book that my late wife Elizabeth and I wrote a couple of years back, COVID and Coming Chaos, with the title, kind of a history of the COVID lockdowns and all the other associated troubles that came about with COVID. And you can get that book for free. Just write to me, Lou Carefully, and ask for that book. Just say something like, "Please send me your book." You don't even need to give the title. Just say, "Please send me your book." Write to me. My address W, Caverly, and that's spelled C-A-V, as in Victor, E-R-L-Y. And the address is Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Once again, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And if you could chip in maybe $5 to cover the cost of the mailing, I'd be happy to mail the book right out to you. Maybe as many as 15 to 20 left. I'm not sure I'll be able to order more once those are gone. Depends upon donations. And, of course, if you'd like to donate to help keep the program on the air, that would be very much appreciated. Same address, Blue Caverly, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And don't forget, if you want to see how else to listen to us, one way is our web mistress, Angel, who has done such a fantastic job for us for many years now. Volunteer work, too. She's been more than kind. And she has a couple of very good websites. I hope I can remember the names now. Let me think now. KStarTalkRadio.com and KingdomStarRadio.com. KStarTalkRadio.com and KingdomStarRadio.com. And she has many programs, including, I think, her own program. She has some programs. The last time I checked, she has some very good things. Many of you remember Dr. Stan Monteith. He has some wonderful programs. Sad to say, he's gone to be with the Lord, but he had a lot of good guests on, much good commentary, and she is repeating many of his best programs on her websites. Again, KingdomStarRadio.com. Make that KStarTalkRadio.com. And KingdomStarRadio.com. So check those out. I think you'll be well rewarded. So now a little bit about crime. In particular, crime that doesn't involve me, because I live out in the country on the eastern side of Chesapeake Bay, in what we call the eastern shore of Maryland. But if you are in a big city, you have to worry about crime, and especially one of the topics is crime on mass transit. This appeared in Fox News, and it says, America's commuters under siege as violent transit crimes endanger blue cities. And the subheading, recent incidents in Charlotte, Chicago, Los Angeles, Boston, and New York City highlight safety concerns for our commuters. This, again, was on Fox News by Julia Bonavita, September 22nd, 2025. Dem crime policies crippling cities, even in red states, as crackdown intensifies, White House warns. The killing of a commuter aboard a North Carolina train is the latest act of violence affecting the United States public transit system, or systems, as reports of other attacks continue to alarm riders. On August 22nd, Irina Zarutska, a 23-year-old Ukrainian refugee, finished a night of working at Sepetys Pizzeria when she boarded a train in Charlotte to make her way home. Surveillance video shows Zarutska still in her uniform taking a seat in front of a man wearing a red hoodie. Moments later, that man can be seen pulling out a knife and stabbing Zarutska to death. Authorities have identified the suspected attacker as DeCarlos Brown, who was arrested on a murder charge. The attack sparked concern around the country, with the possibility of violence impacting low-income and middle-class Americans who rely on public transit. And Lance LaRusso, founder of the Blue Line Lawyer Institute, told Fox News Digital, quote, "Transit violence disproportionately impacts low-income and middle-class Americans because they are the primary users. Riders do not choose their fellow passengers and have no choice but to accept a seat next to someone who may cause them concern. The open access and utility of a mass transit system requires that anyone can ride, unquote. And I'm going to skip down a little bit to some of the other incidents that is being talked about here. And these, of course, are only a very few of the ones that have actually taken place. So now we move to Chicago. Chicago police seek five suspects after man is beaten, robbed on train. Last month, Chicago police announced they are searching for five suspects wanted for their alleged involvement in an attack that left one person injured on the city's Red Line train. That occurred on around 7 a.m. August 13th when five individuals approached a passenger in the loop, according to Fox 32 Chicago. The group allegedly beat the victim before taking his property, the outlet reported. Chicago authorities have not released the condition of the victim and have asked for the public's help in identifying the five alleged attackers. And I believe there's a picture. If you go to this website, it's simply Fox News for September 22nd, and you can see a picture. If any of you live in the Chicago area and know these people, call the police and help them out. The incident comes just months after four people allegedly approached an elderly man on the CTA Red Line train before taking his belongings and beating him, Fox 32 reported. The four suspects, two men and two women, are accused of stealing the senior citizen's cell phone while he was riding the train. When the victim attempted to retrieve his belongings, the group allegedly battered the man before running off. Details regarding the victim's condition remain unknown, and authorities have asked for the public's help in tracking down the four suspects. And then I'm going to skip a little bit. Our time is moving on. It talks about, as you might remember, Daniel Penny, the ex-Marine who put a chokehold on a man who was acting strangely on the New York subway and threatening people. And Penny was actually charged with second-degree manslaughter, but he was acquitted. In fact, one witness, I'll quote from the article, Yvette Rosario, a 19-year-old student, testified in Penny's trial that Neely, that is the one who was choked and died by Penny, Neely shouted that someone would die that day, unquote. And she said, I got scared by the tone that he was saying it. I have seen situations, but not like that. Okay, and then it says Penny was subsequently tried, and he was acquitted in 2024 in what became a hallmark case surrounding the dangers facing commuters on public transit and bystanders' duty to react when law enforcement is not present. And Mr. LoRusso, who was quoted earlier, says, a person on a transit system placed in a violent or threatening situation may be limited in their ability to defend themselves or even escape an attacker. Even other passengers may not be able to assist or summon help for a victim or potential victim. The safety of train, that is transit systems, as transit system users may vary widely across the system and according to the time of day or day of the week, he added. Although the high presence of users is often seen as a safety net and crime deterrent, horrible tragedies have occurred on crowded trains, buses, and transit stations. Then we have one in Los Angeles on the Metro G line bus. A Los Angeles man was hospitalized in grave condition after being stabbed multiple times in the neck while riding the bus in North Hollywood, according to NBC Channel 4. The incident occurred on September 3rd when two men riding the city's Metro G line bus became involved in a verbal argument, the outlet reported. According to witnesses, the altercation reportedly became physical when the alleged attacker pulled out a 4-inch pocket knife and stabbed the victim three times in the neck. The suspect, identified as 23-year-old Logan Dunn, was taken into custody immediately after the attack, and the victim was transported to the hospital in grave condition. And the article goes on to say, authorities have not released an update on the victim's condition or details on what led up to the argument. The LAPD did not immediately respond to Fox News Digital's request for comment. Then my old hometown of Boston, at least home area, Boston man stabbed in the neck on bus following verbal altercation. A 74-year-old Boston man was stabbed in the neck while riding an MBTA bus in September 2024, according to a news release from the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office. Well, I won't read all of this. It says the victim was transported to a local hospital. The perpetrator was taken into custody without incident. And the perpetrator, Abdul Rashid, was already facing a pending case in Roxbury for allegedly stabbing a stranger in 2023. And he was charged with assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, and namely a knife, and assault to murder, stemming from the 2024 incident. He was ordered to be held without bail. Then there was that terrible case of a woman being burned to death by an illegal immigrant in New York City subway attack. Sabrina Ewam, 57, was asleep in a stationary F train at the Coney Island Stillwell Avenue station when a man, later identified as Sebastian Zapita, 33, allegedly approached her before pulling out a lighter and setting her clothes on fire. Surveillance video of the attack shows Ewam standing up while engulfed in flames. She died and was pronounced dead at the scene. Zapita, a previously deported illegal immigrant from Guatemala, was taken into custody hours after the attack. He faces one count of first-degree murder, three counts of second-degree murder, one count of arson. And it goes on to have some words from the district attorney, Eric Gonzalez. He says, this act surprised many New Yorkers as they were getting ready to celebrate the holidays. But now New Yorkers are waking up and understanding that on the 22nd of this year, this happened. This was intentional, and we hope to prove this. If convicted, Zapita would face life without the possibility of parole. On the first-degree murder charge, with the second-degree murder charge, that would carry a potential sentence of 25 years to life, according to the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office. That, again, that article was in Fox News, September 22nd. America's commuters under siege as violent transit crimes endanger blue cities. Okay, going to switch gears again. This one interested me as a former teacher. I have a few of my own comments to it. This was in Fox News, September 12th. Nation's report card gives public schools a failing grade. Parents are demanding better. This is by Robert Enlow at Fox News. American Culture Project senior fellow Corey DeAngelis addresses the many topics currently conflicting school districts across the nation, including gender identity, vaccine mandates, cell phone bans, and more. And this may have been a video. I'm not quite sure the way that sounds. I don't usually bother to copy the videos. Well, obviously, I can't copy them. And sometimes I'll just copy the text. The newest results from the nation's report card were a gut punch. Nearly half of high school seniors scored below basic in math and reading. Compared to 2019, the last time the test was administered, the results were abysmal. It's just one more sign that our education system is falling short of preparing students for college, work, and life. But here's the thing. Parents didn't need another test to tell them this. They see it every day. EdChoice's 2025 Schooling in America survey found that 68% of Americans and 60% of parents believe K-12 education is on the wrong track. Families are already deeply concerned about the quality of education that kids are receiving, and they're searching for something better. Additionally, our polling consistently finds that more than half of parents say they prefer a school other than their local district school if given the choice. Yet, Roughly 8 in 10 children remain in those schools. Parents want change, but too many either don't know what options are available to them or run into barriers when they try to make a switch. But when they do get the chance to choose, the difference in satisfaction with their school is striking. About half of private school parents, 49%, say they are very satisfied. Now, that's private school. Very satisfied with their child's schooling experience, a whopping 17 points higher than public school parents. When families can match their child's needs with the right environment, kids thrive. Parents are less stressed, and whole communities benefit. The good news for us is that school choice is no longer just a talking point. It's increasingly becoming the norm across the country. Many states now offer educational choice programs available to every student, while many others have programs serving targeted groups. In just the past year, enrollment in private choice programs grew by 25% nationwide, surpassing 1.3 million students. Families are voting with their feet, moving towards schools and programs they believe will help their children succeed. Why? Because the evidence backs them up. Study after study shows that educational choice benefits students academically, strengthens civic values, boosts parental satisfaction, and even improves public schools. Well, our time is limited today, so I won't read all of this, but it goes on to describe some of the results. It says the latest NAEP, National Assessment of Educational Progress, that's the test they spoke of, their scores should jolt policymakers into action. We cannot keep sending students to schools that aren't working for them just because of where they live. Well, that makes sense. Stakes could not be higher. That also makes sense. But this article is a former educator. Now, this is me speaking, Lou. As a former educator, I have to say that that article says what you'd like to have happen. It doesn't say how. It's all well and good to say the private schools do better, but private schools are expensive. Many parents simply can't afford to send their children to a private school. I've taught in both public and private schools. And one of the things about public schools is many times the administrators and the teachers are limited in what they can do to make a good classroom atmosphere. We all know of situations, well, if you have kids, surely you know about them, where one disruptive student can ruin a whole class and put the teacher into a frenzy. And many times, politics rears its ugly head and says you may not discipline a student for whatever reasons. Maybe because it's considered racist. Maybe because it's considered attacking students who are in some way handicapped mentally or socially. But the fact is, when you allow students who disrupt the class to remain in the classroom, you naturally have the quality of education go down for everybody in that classroom. And not to mention, you drive a lot of teachers out of the profession. If I had to do over again, I have to admit, I'd think twice before becoming a teacher. Not because I didn't love the students. Not because I didn't love teaching the students. But because there were so many things put in the way. Now, you might say, well, it's the administrator's fault. No, it's not. I've had wonderful administrators I worked under, but they too were told you can't suspend a student for so-and-so infraction, or you can't suspend more than X number of students in a given time period because it reflects badly on the school system. Well, that's a very strange argument. What reflects worse in the school system is when the results come in, like these test results just spoken about in the article. That article, by the way, was on Fox News on September 12th. If you want to read the details, Nation's report card gives public schools a failing grade. Parents are demanding better. But until some of these root problems, not so much at the schools themselves, but at the upper levels, the school boards, the county school personnel above the level of the principals, until some of these problems are corrected, and I don't know when they will be, you're going to see these same things happen time and time again. America's education system is way down compared to a lot of other countries in the world. And there are problems, real problems. Homelessness, bad home life for a lot of inner-city students, and there's no denying that. But if you want the school systems to improve, really a lot of the problems go very deep, and you've got to tackle those. Well, how about next week? We've got some things I really intended to get to from my good friend up in Boston, who sends me some things from the Boston Herald, mainly about ICE and the lack of cooperation with the mayor of Boston and the governor of Massachusetts, who are still fighting desperately to keep illegal immigrants, even criminal ones, from being taken by ICE and deported. These Democrat leaders in the state have just made an awful mess. So we'll get to some of that next week. I promise you I'll read you a few highlights from that. And also from the New York Post. Had some good things there, too, that this intrepid listener sends to me every week. So I want to thank him. And I want to thank all of you for listening. If you'd like to write to me, contributions, suggestions, criticism, just write to me, Lou Caroli, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. I want to thank you for listening. And tune in again next week. And we'll try to give you some more interesting and informative information. Thank you, and good night.